And so these bricks, with the name of the brickmaker molded into them, are littered everywhere. They're in creek beds, they're in railroad tracks, they're in demolition sites. They're even on the banks of rivers where these brickyards used to be.
My shirt tore in half. I fell, and when I fell, I ripped my pants in like a magical kind of tear that circumnavigated all the way from the bottom of my fly to my butt.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Stoop. I'm Laura Wexler.
And I'm Jessica Henkin. And this week on the podcast, Oddball Jobs, two stories from lovely, quirky people who do weird things for a living. We like weird.
I know. Weird's good. It's passionate.
Yeah.
It's odd.
First, we want to thank our sponsor, the Park School, which is a pre-K through grade 12 non-sectarian, progressive, awesome place to learn.
So this first story is told by a guy with an obsession. And obsession stories are awesome. I mean, what is more entertaining than someone who has a quest that's like Don Quixote and you get to go on the journey with them as they bat at windmills? That actually metaphor does not really work in this situation because the story is about bricks, as you'll see. So hopefully he's not batting bricks at windmills. Anyway, take a listen to Max Pollock's story.
So I'm going to talk about bricks for about 6 minutes. So if anybody wants to leave now. But I moved to Baltimore because of bricks, in all seriousness. And I'm going to tell you how something like that happens. So after school, I moved back to Tacoma Park with my parents. And at that time, my dad was sort of the brick connoisseur in the family. And connoisseur is a strong word for what he was. He picked up loose bricks that he found on the street. On his way home from work, he would get off the metro. He was wearing a suit and tie. He's a very presentable, professional man. But as he walked home, he would find bricks on the street, and he would put them in his briefcase, and he would bring them home. The idea was to make a patio. So the idea was that he would take two bricks every day for years. And at the end, there'd be a patio there. So I thought this whole thing was ridiculous. I gave him a hard time about it, but after a while I thought, you know, the right thing to do would be to help this man. So I told him I'd help and that I too would go out there and I would sort of scavenge for stray bricks to help my dad. At the very least, we'd finish the project quicker. So that's how I started to sort of have this interest in bricks. And when you start to look for bricks, you notice that bricks are everywhere. And when you start to handle enough bricks, you notice that, you know, all bricks are not created equal. They come in different shapes and colors and sizes and textures. And when you get real lucky, you'll find a brick that actually has the name of the brick maker sort of impressed, sort of molded right into the brick. You know, 100 years ago, there were thousands and thousands of brickmakers. And so these bricks, with the name of the brickmaker molded into them, are littered everywhere. They're in creek beds, they're in railroad tracks, they're in demolition sites. They're even on the banks of rivers where these brickyards used to be. And so when you're digging through rubble, when you're sort of pulling debris from a building, when you're digging through mud, and you find one of these bricks, it sort of acts as this real solid evidence of a business or an industry or a person or a place that may no longer exist. So if you can't tell, this passing interest sort of became my hobby, and then this hobby sort of became my obsession. I would skip work to go looking for bricks. That's not a joke. My girlfriend at the time, who thankfully is now my wife, showed incredible patience and incredibly poor judgment in letting me put about 500 bricks in our dining room. Whenever I would visit a new city, I'd spend half the time sort of hunting for bricks, and I'd be at the airport, and the guy would have my luggage, and he would say, "What do you have, bricks in here?" And I would say, "Yes." And he would call security. But so when you have a weird hobby like this, people notice and your friends give you a hard time, but they also, anything brick-related, they sort of send your way. So I was sitting in my office. I was working at a desk job in D.C. I was bored out of my mind. And a friend of mine sent me an article. And the article was about how in Baltimore, they were trying to do this pilot program where they would actually salvage bricks from buildings here in Baltimore. But they didn't know how to do it, and they didn't know what they were going to do with the bricks. And it's not an exaggeration to say that I read this article, I put in my 2 weeks' notice, I got on the phone to some folks I knew in Baltimore, and I said, I swear to you, you will not find anybody who cares more about bricks than I do. And so that's the short story of how this hobby becomes a passion and ultimately becomes my job. Now, if you believe in kismet or mysticism or any sort of cosmic thing, I can tell you that I was sort of destined to do this work. A few years into this brick fascination, my mom came up to me and she said, gosh, isn't it just so funny that you have this thing with bricks and my last name means brick? And it's one of these weird things where I'd known my mother all my life, and I'd, for 30 years, I'd never thought to ask, Mom, what does your last name mean? But her last name is Kirpich. It means brick in Russian. And it turns out that my family, I come from a long line of brickmakers in the old country. So I come by this honestly. This is, it's in my blood. So I had this job. It's a dream job. You know, like a year or 5 years ago, I was skipping work to go into abandoned buildings to collect bricks. Now I was getting paid to go into abandoned buildings and collect bricks. But someone asked, well, isn't there a danger in mixing work and pleasure like that? In other words, if I was going to be around bricks 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, would I ever get tired of them? And the answer is yes, but also no. So in the past 5 years, we've salvaged about 1.5 million bricks from here in Baltimore. I think I've touched about 250,000 of those. It is dirty work. It is hard work. There really are days when I would be very happy to never see a brick again. But there are also days that make it all worth it. I remember once I was sort of disassembling a building in East Baltimore. And I was on the second floor of this old row house. We were taking apart a wall piece by piece. And I plucked a brick from a wall. And when you do what I do and you salvage literally millions of bricks, you don't spend a lot of time looking at each brick. But for some reason, something on this brick caught my eye. And I dusted it off. And there in this very elegant cursive were the words, James Walker, 1906. Now, this was different than finding the name of a brick company in a brick. Those bricks were mass-produced. There are hundreds of millions of those bricks out there. But this was a person. This was someone who 110 years ago had taken the time to write his name in a wet piece of clay. I began to think about James Walker and who he was and what his life was like and what made him write his name. Was he bored? Was he trying to leave his mark? I mean, surely he must have known that this brick would have been sent to a building and it would have been laid in a wall and it would have had mortar placed on top of it and it would have had 1,000 more bricks placed on top of it. He had to have known that this brick would end up being one of hundreds of millions that make up Baltimore, that make up our city. And so I wonder what he would have thought if he had known that in a distant future, someone, another Baltimorean, would be taking apart a wall piece by piece and would find a brick and dust it off and find his name intact after all these years. Thank you.
All right. That's such a charming story. I love his father in that story.
And also, doesn't it make you feel good when someone has like a pure love for something and then it turns into a way to make a living?
Yes.
That's like the best, like happily ever after fairy tale, and just so rarely happens.
It's a fairy tale, exactly.
Yeah. But it's true.
So we also want to thank Golden West, which is a delicious restaurant located in Hamden in Baltimore. They've been around since 1997. They have a vegan forward menu, and that's Southwest inspired.
And we want to thank Baltimore Magazine, who's been a sponsor of this stoop for a long time, and we appreciate it. They passionately chronicle and celebrate this complicated and creative and wonderful city. And they've got a new podcast called Local Flavor Live, which is all about the dining scene here in Baltimore. So you can check all that out at baltimoremagazine.com.
So Joe Wall is our next storyteller.
Joe Wall.
You have heard him before on this podcast, and if you've come to live shows, you may have seen him. He has told some epic tales. This one was from a show that we did at the Baltimore Museum of Industry this past spring about jobs, and it is a tale about his time working in the Bromo Seltzer Tower.
Yeah, clock tower.
The clock tower. Yeah, take a listen.
I don't know if you guys have a boss that keeps an eye on you, but when I was working in Baltimore, I had a newspaper column. I don't know if you remember Who's Reponable in the city paper, but it was a funny little photographic documentation of things gone wrong in the city, and I ended up in it a lot. And it was partly because I ended up managing a lot of city landmarks. Like, I worked the facility manager for the American Visionary Art Museum after helping to build the mosaic there. And I finally ended up working at the Bromo Seltzer Tower, which was sort of a dream because my grandmother had introduced me to it as a kid when she would take me to see blaxploitation films at the Hippodrome. She loved Pam Grier and would always tell me, Jebby, one day I'm going to start carrying a straight razor up in my beehive and see if they mess with me then. So when I got headhunted to take over the Bromo Tower, I had to do it. I love the visionary, but it's the Bromo Tower. I had to take it on. And it was kind of an interesting job. I managed a lot of the details of, like, getting the space rented. It's all, as you know, or most of you know, it is occupied by artist studios and exhibition space. It had a great stress-relieving thing that when I was really strung out, I could always just go up into the clock room and do maintenance on the clock. And the trouble was, I didn't know anything about maintaining a 100-year-old four-face Seth Thomas tower clock. I was a gearhead. It was just a little bit different than French cars and Vespas. But by the time they went to do the restoration, as you know, the tower has had its original clock mechanism restored. It's working like it did in 1913 with a pendulum and everything. When they were setting up to do that, the family who was going to do the restoration came in and they said, you have done such a good job maintaining this. It's perfect. It's been kept clean. The things have been done right. And I said, you don't know the half of it. Because one of these days, I was working on the clock. Time was rolling out. I had to catch the last MARC train out of the city or I would be stranded in Baltimore. And that's not bad, but it is. So I ran out after working on the clock, and I did not realize I'd left a ladder in sort of an odd position. And when I came in the next morning, I got off the MARC train at Camden Yards, and I looked up, and the clock was stopped. And I thought, oh, God, I'm going to end up in the paper. So I head up the street, and I come on in, and what had happened is the drive shafts for that clock had big balance bars on them, and I had left the ladder I was using to work on it a little too close, and when I got to the clock room, it had picked it up and turned it all the way around the room and jammed it against the ceiling 25 feet overhead, this 16-foot A-frame ladder, and I'm thinking, I have no idea how I'm going to deal with this. Well, we had an old ladder that we had replaced, the original 100-year-old ladder that came with the tower when it was new. So I climbed up on this rickety thing, which is like being up on the mast of a ship, and I just kind of very carefully unbolted the drive shaft that was attached to the ladder, thinking it'll just effortlessly fall down. I'll pick it up. It'll be fine. I'll reset the clock faces and everything will be great. But that's not actually what happened. What had happened is because in the old days the clock was powered by a motor, unlike the pendulum mechanism, which when something jams it, it'll just stop, the motor just keeps winding it up and up and up. So I unbolted it, and the second I did, the ladder swung down onto the elevator mechanisms. And from behind me, the other balance bar that was nearest to me flew around and conked me in the head like a Three Stooges bit, at which point I turned and the gears for that part of the clock face caught my shirt and pulled me up into the machinery, at which point I was dangling and making a lot of noise. My shirt tore in half. I fell, and when I fell, I ripped my pants in like a magical kind of tear that circumnavigated all the way from the bottom of my fly to my butt. And I thought, I have to take a train home. I have no pants, and I have half a shirt, and I'm a husky guy, and we don't take our shirts off ever. But fortunately, I had a nun's habit in my office. So I decided at the end of the day, I'm gonna get my nerve up. I'm gonna put on the nun's habit, but not the cowl and the wimple, and get on that train looking like an Amish drag queen and pretend to everybody in the universe, this is just okay. This is what people do now. Yeah, occasionally the big black shift. And so when the clock people asked me, they said, where did you learn how to work on the clock? And I said, I don't know. I've had some experiences with it. It's taught me a few lessons, and that was mine. Thank you.
Says 12 noon. Guess I better get up soon. You feel like he needs his own show.
Yeah.
Like Joe Wall
so
stories.
Funny.
Joe Wall stories, like
so
wild.
Likeable. Yeah, you should go back if you want and listen to his very first story on
search
the
him on our site. Yeah. Is that the one where he's
at camp?
Yes. Oh, the camp one, but then there's also where he MCs the
special. Yes, that's the middle.
That's in NC-17.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. That one's less. That's more illuminating in his later life, about his later life. The first story is about his childhood.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So we recommend Joe Wall stories, and you can check them out at stoopstorytelling.com or just Google Joe Wall the Stoop, and you'll turn them up. We want to thank The Wine Source, located at 3601 Elm Avenue, for their sponsorship of the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. And we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to find out more about our live shows, we've got a great show coming on October 24th at the Senator Theater, Twilight Zone, stories about everything from the super natural to the super weird. We've got our whole season at stoopstorytelling.com. And we want to thank Maureen Harvey,
who's
producing this show. And we want her to know we remember to thank her without her reminding us. All right, y'all. See you next week.
See you next week.